can you start by describing what it is you do and how you came to be doing it?
Sure. Well, I work at the Genome Center at Washington University in St. Louis, and we are one of the handful or so of large-scale genome sequencing centers around the world. And what that means is essentially we participate in large genome sequencing projects that some people may have heard of, like the Human Genome Project, the Thousand Genomes Project, things like that. And we do a lot involved in that is a lot of data processing, laboratory processing, tracking, and all sorts of things. So it's a rather large enterprise. There's about 300 or so people that work here. And how I came to work here was about 8 years ago. I decided that I wanted to get more into programming and more into open science and these sorts of things. So I took a job as a programmer here at the Genome Center and gradually sort of worked my way around to where I am now, where I oversee all of the software development and IT infrastructure here at the Genome Center. And it's a fairly large IT infrastructure. We have somewhere around 3 petabytes of storage online and somewhere north of 3,000 cores in our computational cluster. And we're generating terabytes, tens of terabytes of data per day with our current sequencing instruments. And the sorts of things that we're doing now as we transition from more fundamental evolutionary type of projects, such as the Human Genome Project and subsequent projects like the Mouse Genome Project. We've done things like corn and things of that nature. Now we're doing more and more sequencing projects related to medicine and medical sequencing. Last year we published the first whole cancer genome sequence, and it's matched normal. In doing both the cancer and the normal, we were able to determine the differences between those two genomes and begin to identify what might have possibly caused cancer in that individual. And so projects like that, we're also doing projects with metabolic syndromes like diabetes and several other cancer projects as well. And so that's essentially what we're doing and how we're doing it and how I got here.
Genomics is an area that seems to be on the steep part of the hockey stick curve right now. In just a decade, we've gone from sequencing one genome over a period of years to doing them routinely. Can you talk a bit about what's enabled this acceleration?
Well, a whole host of things, but I think really at the core was the changing fundamentals of sequencing itself. For a long time, DNA sequencing was based on a process invented by Sanger, sometimes called Sanger sequencing, sometimes called capillary electrophoresis now because of the last revision of the instruments that were generated. But essentially in those, with that approach, you did reactions in 96 plate wells, and you sort of processed sequence in these 96 plate well chunks, and you did reactions in there, you loaded them on the readers, and the readers read out sequence for each of those 96 wells. And so that's sort of how you processed it. And at the height of that sort of sequencing, which was only a few years ago, we had about 130 or so of those instruments, each churning about 15 to 20 runs per day. And so each run gave you 100 pieces of sequences. You had, 100 or so machines. And so you got on the order of, a few thousand sequence reads is what we called them because of the way the instrument read the information. Now, since that time, 454 was first, and then Celexa, which was later bought out by Illumina, came, and the ABI Solid has a platform. There's one from Helicos as well, and then several other third generation, those first being the second generation, sequencers have come out. And what those do is greatly increase the parallelism with which you're able to process DNA and sequence it. And so instead of a few thousand runs per day or a few thousand reads per day, you may get a few million reads per run. And these runs for some of the platforms do take a little bit longer, but the parallelism of it increases your throughput tremendously. And so now we have about 35, 40 of these instruments, of these highly parallel instruments in-house. And with that, we're able to sequence a human genome to complete coverage in less than a week. So the main driver has been this change in the sequencing technology and the parallelism of it. It's a fundamentally different chemistry, different physics, and everything like that. The flip side of it is that you talked about the hockey stick, and so that hockey stick is the sequencing hockey stick, but it's brought several other hockey sticks along with it, mainly the amount of data that these things generate and the amount of processing power that is required to process that data has increased greatly as well. So much faster than Moore's Law over the last 2 years or so. And so whereas with those original instruments, you would generate on the order of megabytes per day, now we're doing terabytes, tens of terabytes per day with these new instruments. So, and then processing that, instead of taking a single processor a few minutes, it can take a small cluster a few days to actually analyze the data from each of these runs. So those are the main things. And so building the infrastructure, so the enabling technology was the change in the sequencing chemistry itself. And then what had to come along with that was building these infrastructures to be able to track these things and process these things and store all of this data as the instruments increase in their abilities.
As you mentioned, you've moved on from humans to mice and now plants and other life forms. How is the decision made as to what to sequence next?
Well, there's a lot of things that go into that. Originally, when you were talking about, well, even before the Human Genome Project, there was a large discussion and debate as to what would be the first multicellular organism to be sequenced. And the main contenders were C. elegans and Drosophila melanogaster, the fruit fly. C. elegans is a small roundworm. And eventually C. elegans won, or was chosen, I should say. And that was the first multicellular organism, and that was done as a prototype for the approach that would be used for the Human Genome Project. And that essentially was done through a consortium, and the funding agencies got people together, and there was meetings and discussions, and eventually one was chosen. After the Human Genome Project, there were a few organisms that were highly relevant to genetic research. For example, the mouse. There's many disease models of human diseases in mice, different strains of mice and these sorts of things. And so that was a natural next step after the Human Genome Project. And then you have other things that are of evolutionary interest, other great apes like the chimpanzee was after the mouse. But at that point, the sequencing capacity of the centers started to increase. We were still on the former Sanger sequencing capillary electrophoresis solution, but we got better and better at what we were doing. The machines got more efficient, more reliable, and these sorts of things. So the capacity increased, and so there began to be a need to fill that capacity with more and more organisms. And so what the funding agencies set up was a white paper process where people who were studying different organisms would write a white paper explaining their organism and why that it should be sequenced and what it would add to the scientific knowledge. And then those would be reviewed by a panel at the funding agencies and then selected and assigned to the different sequencing centers or several sequencing centers if the projects were big enough. So that's sort of how the reference genomes, so you know, the animals and the plants and things like that were chosen. Some things were done through their own, for example, with the corn. That was a joint project between several different funding agencies in the National Institutes of Health. And they got together, decided they wanted to do this strain of corn or maize, and that was assigned and done. And then there's been international consortium, like, is driving the Thousand Genomes Project, where they wanted to do the sequencing of hundreds or even thousands of genomes. And that, you know, again, was sort of bandied about by scientific luminaries around the field of genomics. And then a proposal was made, and the different funding agencies around the world that sort of direct the centers and give them their money, you know, weighed in on these things, and then the project was done. And then some of it is driven, you know, purely through collaborations that the genome centers have, either externally or internally. For example, with the AML sequencing of the first cancer genome, that was done with a collaborator here at Washington University in St. Louis. And we actually went and got the funding for that ourselves because we thought it was such a compelling project. And so there's a whole host of ways that these things get chosen and done, but that sort of outlines the major ways.
The Human Genome Initiative was a huge multi-center effort. It sounds like it can be pretty much done in-house by a single facility now. How many facilities are there that can do a complete sequence at this point?
That's hard to say. I think that number changes every day, but it's probably in the hundreds, if not thousands, nowadays. Basically, you could do it in a few months with a single instrument. Although the project is a little bit different now than it was then. And so what do I mean about that? We already have the human reference, and the type of data that you get from these instruments is of the nature that you can't easily do something from scratch, what we call a de novo genomic assembly. But what you can do is take these reads and then align them back to the reference and see, oh, I have this chunk of DNA here. Where does that live in the human genome? And how does it differ from the reference human genome and stuff like that? That's what we call resequencing. That is sequencing an organism that you already have a reference for. So in that sense, because the Human Genome Project has done and the human reference sequence exists, it enables us to be able to do these new sorts of projects in a lot less time, along with new technology.
It's kind of like the difference between trying to do a puzzle where you don't have the box cover and one where you do, I guess.
That's a fairly good analogy, yes. I mean, if you had a puzzle where you didn't have the box cover and you had four pieces, it would be pretty easy to figure out. If you have 3 billion, it would be very difficult. You know, and as you get closer, you know, if you move away from four and get closer to 3 billion, it becomes harder and harder. And that's sort of the case here, is where if you have lots of small pieces, if you have something to compare it to, it makes the project simpler and more amenable to that sort of data type. Whereas if you get it in big chunks, it's sort of independent.
It sounds like there are really a lot of informatic challenges with genomic data. There's the computational challenge of doing the sequence, which you mentioned. There's a challenge of managing the resulting data and finding meaning in it. And then there's a challenge of applying that understanding to a larger population. First of all, did I miss any of the challenges? And second of all, what are kind of the unique problems in each set of those?
Well, let me talk a little bit about each of the ones you did mention, and maybe that'll bring up some that you didn't. So as far as just analyzing the data and generating the data, that is computationally intensive, because essentially what you're getting off of these new instruments is pictures, images. And you need to apply algorithms to detect features in those images and then translate those features, accounting for the different vagaries of chemistry and these sorts of things. And then resulting in a sequence, a series of base calls, A's, G's, C's, and T's, the building blocks of DNA. Once you have that information, there's a whole host of sort of secondary analyses or analyses of biological relevance, if you want to think of it that way, that need to happen. And those are project specific. So for some sorts of projects, for example, a cancer sort of project, you would want to find all the ways that the DNA that you sequenced differs from the reference, and then take for the tumor, let's say, and then for the normal, do the same thing. And then for all of those variants, find out which ones are unique to the tumor genome as compared to the normal genome. And then once you find those variants, you want to figure out what they mean, what they do. You know, the human genome is only about 1% coding into proteins. And so that's what we were always told that DNA does. DNA encodes RNA, and then RNA becomes proteins. And the proteins do the work of the cell. but only 1% of human DNA actually encodes proteins. The rest, some of it may be junk. For a long time, most of it was thought to be junk, but now more and more, as we learn more about the genome, we find that there's a lot of stuff that may have very subtle effects on what genes are transcribed into proteins and what aren't, turning genes on and off, if you will, and other regulatory things and non-coding RNAs and all sorts of different things that the DNA that's not coding into proteins may do. And so you want to find out of those variations, which ones are doing what? Where do they sit? How might they affect a protein if they sit in that region? How might they affect a promoter region if they sit in that region? These sorts of things. And so there's, once you find the variations, you want to find out what they do and what they might mean biologically. Now, for other sorts of analyses, for example, if you're sequencing an organism for the first time, you may be using longer sequence that you get from, say, the 454 instrument, which is a few hundred bases long, as opposed to like the Illumina instrument, which is anywhere from 75 to 100 or so bases long. And on those sorts of projects, what you want to do is try to assemble those bits and pieces together. And so while the bits aren't as big as they used to be with the Sanger sequencing, where they were 700-800 bases long, they're long enough that for simpler genomes, without a lot of complex features, you can assemble them pretty well together and get an assembled genome of a fair quality. And that can be a very computationally intensive thing. And as also, and the other, one of the other problems you indicated, so we've talked about sort of just generating the sequence and then analyzing the sequence. Another one that you talked about was tracking all this. When you have 30, 40 of these machines all going, starting and stopping at all sorts of different times, generating data, the data for a single project can be splayed across several instruments over several months, depending on how the project is done and how busy things are. Sort of keeping track of all that data, what's traditionally been called a LIMS, a Laboratory Information Management System, can be challenging. Add on to that the fact that we provide community resources. So we're not just generating sequence for our own sake. Once we generate it, we want to submit it to central repository so that other people can access it and get information from it and build on the information that we're providing. And so taking all that information that was created while you track the sample as it went through the pipeline, tacking that on to the actual sequence data and then submitting that in bulk. And nowadays we're, you know, submitting hundreds of gigabytes per hour in some cases. So that can be a real challenge. There's also the challenge of analysis. As we have generate more and more data, you're able to ask more and more complex questions. You talked about, you know, the Human Genome Project. We spent years generating the sequence for one genome. Now with 35, 40 machines, we can generate lots of sequence on lots of different humans. And so that opens up a whole new line of analysis of comparative genomics, where you're comparing human to human to human to human to human genomes. And so this was a sort of analysis that wasn't even feasible 2 years ago. And now it's something that's becoming more and more routine. And so not only do you have to do a lot of analysis that requires disk space and CPU time, but you also want to track these sorts of analysis in the same way that you track your laboratory processing, because you know you want to track what genomes have you analyzed, which haven't, you know, what set of parameters were used on this genome versus that genome. You know, you may want to analyze a single genome several different ways to figure out which sets of tools and processing profiles and input parameters and filters and all these sorts of things provide the best answer, the most realistic answer, giving you the most sensitivity and the highest specificity, these sorts of things. And then you want to create the ability to compare and contrast all the results that you get so that you can discern what are the good results, what are the bad results, what makes sense, what doesn't make sense. And so essentially what we find is that we're creating the equivalent of a laboratory information management system for analysis so that we can not only do the analysis in a computational way, but also be able to track it and keep good data provenance for the data that's out there and the analysis and the results of those sorts of things. And then one of the difficulties, I guess, that you didn't mention was just sort of interoperability. The pace at which all of this stuff is changing and moving is very fast, and we have, you know, significant resources inside that we're always trying to push the envelope and improve how we do things. And everybody else that's working on these systems is doing the same sorts of things. And so always pushing that envelope, but still being able to compare and contrast what one site is doing versus another site, sharing the data, getting it back and forth, sharing software that's often made with great rapidity, often highly customized to occur to a single environment, the environment that you're developing in, just for a speed so that you can develop it more and more quickly, sharing software, sharing data, these sorts of things. That's a real significant challenge because of the way that the pace at which things are changing now.
People can get huge amounts of data about their genome for a few $100 now, and the day is coming soon when a full genome sequencing is just going to be a matter of swiping your credit card. The actual genome itself is only about 3 gigabytes, but in itself it's pretty meaningless to somebody. There are already some good open source tools and databases to help people look at their single nucleotide polymorphism data, but having used one, they're pretty geeky to use. Is it coming time that we're going to need the equivalent of a Firefox for the genome?
Well, maybe a Firefox plugin, right? Everything is sort of trending in that direction. You know, with the consumer tools that are available now, you're essentially getting information on SNPs, single nucleotide polymorphisms. They call them genome scans and stuff like that, but that's essentially what you're getting. There is, I think, Knome or something like that will sequence your genome for a couple $100,000 or $100,000 or something like that. But yeah, I mean, sequencing, the cost of sequencing will be below $50,000 for a whole human genome by the end of this year, if not, and it could be significantly lower than that. So the difficulty is when you talk about the sequence itself being not that useful, that's absolutely true. But the other side of that is the interpretation that we're able to put on a lot of the genome is also not that useful. There's only a small subset of the genome that we really understand well what it does and how it behaves, and if you change it, what that means for development or health or what have you. There are vast swaths of the genome that we really don't understand what they do and how they necessarily interact with the rest of the genome or with the proteins or the cell or these sorts of things. So commensurate with increasing technology and driving down the cost is going to create a wealth of data that we're really going to have to find new ways to mine and get information from so that we can better understand what these vast stretches of the genome that we currently don't have a good understanding of do. And once we have that, then you're going to see, and I mean, it's going to be a leapfrogging thing where more and more data is generated, we gain more and more understanding, and they keep leapfrogging each other. And what's going to happen is you're going to see, you know, as opposed to sort of a big splash of a version 1.0 of some sort of genome browser, you're going to see a gradual increase, you know, gradual in, on the relative scale. I mean, it's obviously going to be rapid on the time scale of, you know, genetic studies and stuff like that. It'll be over the next, you know, few years. But what you're going to see is our ability to take a whole human genome sequence and really be able to map that into the sort of health risks and disease risks and these sorts of things that these SNP companies are essentially layering on top of their SNP array data for people. And it's going to be a much wider scope of information, but it's also going to be a lot more complex because the human body, the cell, and everything like that, it's a very complex system. And, you know, the sort of information that you're going to get from it is going to be more advisory and probabilistic than as opposed to some sort of binary yes, no, you're going to get disease XYZ.
So it's not going to be Gattaca. It's going to be much more you might die by the time you're 30.
I think, yeah, I don't think, well, you know, even in Gattaca, that there was some wiggle room, right? Because he ended up on the spaceship, right? So, genomics is not destiny, I would say, and I think as we come to understand it more and more, I think what we will be understanding are the subtleties, as opposed to the black and whites. I think the black and whites are already pretty clear, and what we're going to be investigating for the time being is these shades of gray of, you know, what does this change mean, and how does it affect your susceptibility to this, that, or the other thing.
You mentioned earlier you're currently working with cancer genomics. It sounds like if you're comparing a non-cancerous cell to a cancerous cell, it sounds like that would be a fairly straightforward, this is different thing. Where do the complexities come in that?
Well, I think the scale is difficult, for one. Also, the linking of the variations between one, between the two, the differences between the two to something that's biologically meaningful. It certainly was a lot harder a year ago when we started this, because the throughput of the machines was such that you needed, you know, 100 runs or so to get the amount of data that you want. Now you need somewhere around 3 or 4 runs to get what you need for a single human genome. So it's, I think the difficulty is getting further and further downstream. So initially, the difficulty was getting these instruments to work right, to getting them to behave well in a laboratory setting, to perform reliably. Then it was aggregating all this data and developing the tools to process it and make sense of it. We have that pretty well under control. And so now the difficulty is pushing further and further down the pipeline, if you will. Now we can run these instruments, we can generate a lot of data, we can align it to the human reference, we can detect the variants, we can determine which variants exist in one genome versus another genome. Those variants that are cancerous, specific to the cancer genome, we can annotate those and say these are in genes, these ones that are in genes change the protein that gene is encoding, these ones are in regulatory regions, you know, these ones are in non and repetitive regions, these sorts of things. So we can do all those things relatively easily, and now the difficulty is sort of following up on all those and figuring out what they mean for the cancer. And, okay, we know they're different. We know that they exist in the cancer genome, but which ones are drivers and which ones are passengers? And what that means is, you know, which are the ones that were the cancer-initiating events and which are the ones that are just coming along for the ride and don't really have anything to do with the tumor genesis or the disease itself, but just because cancer is so out of control and lots of things have gone wrong in the cell, finding which ones are actually causative is becoming more and more the challenge now. And then I think the other big challenge is this is a sort of multi-genome analysis and the ability to sort of look at a bunch of genomes and begin to see patterns and figure out what's important and what's not important.
Just to clarify, when you talk about going against a reference, do you have like one, are you going against one genome reference, or are you comparing it with the same individual in a non-cancerous area?
Well, both, actually. So what we do, the first thing that we do is both and a little bit more. So the first thing that we do with these sequence reads when they come off the instrument is we align them to for a human, we would align them to the human reference. There's just an international consortium that curates the human reference. And so it's just essentially a chromosome by chromosome description of the human genome. Now, once we have that, what we do is detect differences between the sequence that we have and that reference. Then what we do is all the variants that are already known. So there are databases of known variation. One of them is called dbSNP, the database of single nucleotide polymorphisms. And so we'll compare the variations that we got against the variations in dbSNP, and we'll essentially throw away all the ones that exist in dbSNP because those are known to be just normal variation between, from one individual to another. And then we'll go and then we'll compare the variance to, for example, the variants that still remain in the tumor genome versus the variants that still remain in the normal genome. And so in this way, it's sort of a whittling down. And so, we do the alignments first, we find out what's different, we end up with a much smaller number of pieces of information to follow and to process. We take those, we whittle them down even further by getting rid of the ones that have already been previously described. Then we go down and compare the tumor to normal, and then we end up with, we go from somewhere between around 3.5 million, well, we go from somewhere around 90 gigabases of sequence information to 3.5 million variations, to then somewhere around a few hundred variations that are different in a tumor than in a normal.
Just out of curiosity, just between any two cells in a body, is there a significant variation?
There shouldn't be, but there can be, yes. So between two humans, the difference is about one every 1,000 or so bases, I believe, if I recall correctly. And between two cells, one cell right next to the other, they should be identical copies of each other. But sometimes mistakes are made in the process of copying the DNA. And so some difference may exist. However, we're not at present currently sequencing single cells. We'll collect a host of cells and isolate the DNA from a host of cells. And so what you end up is with, when you read the sequence out on these things, is essentially an average of this DNA sequence. It's digital in that eventually you get down to a single piece of DNA. But, once you align these things back, if you see 30 reads that all align to the same region of the genome, and only one of them has a A at the position and all the others have a T at that position, you can't say whether that A was actually some small change between one cell and its 99 closest neighbors, or whether that was just an error in the sequencing. So it's hard to say cell to cell how much difference there is. But of course, that difference does exist. Otherwise, you wouldn't, that's mutation, and that's what eventually leads to cancer and these and other diseases.
To finish off, apart from your talk you're giving at OSCON, which is going to be on a lot of the technology that you're using here and how it fits in with open source, is there anything that you are particularly looking forward to see or you think would be really cool at the conference?
Well, we use a lot of Perl here, so I'm looking forward to the State of the Onion. I'm looking forward to a lot of the talks on database in the database track and things like that to get a better understanding of what other people are doing, because there's a lot of disciplines that are dealing with significantly more data than they had 5 or 10 years ago. Or there are some disciplines that didn't even exist 5 or 10 years ago that are dealing with a lot of data nowadays. And so this is something that we face all the time. And so I'm interested in finding out how people are dealing with that and what tools that they're using. One of the things that we're looking to develop so that as a resource for other people, in addition to the sequence that we generate, is also software. And a lot of places don't have the infrastructure computationally or storage-wise that we have. And so we're looking to develop tools that would enable more and more people to leverage things like Open Science Grid and cloud computing to be able to analyze these data, these sequence data. So I'm interested in attending those sorts of talks as well.
All right. Well, David, thank you so much for taking the time to us. It was really fascinating. And I'm sure anyone who comes to your talk at OSCON is going to come away with their eyes wide open.
I hope so. Thank you.